This is CliffCentral.com.
Platform. Fear is a powerful thing. I mean, it's got a lot of firepower. If you can figure out a way to wrestle that fear to push you from behind rather than stand in front of you, that's very powerful.
I have a dream.
Multiplying leadership, moving society, the millennial way.
You don't want to end up going after goals and dreams and neglect yourself.
Welcome to the Youth Leadership Platform with your host, Bongani Dao.
Take control. Take control of your city. This is the instrument of your liberation.
See, old friend, I brought more soldiers than you did.
Identify yourself to the world.
Youth Leadership Platform.
All right, just like that, you have landed once more on the hottest, uncensored, unradio platform in South Africa and internationally, really. And you tuned into the Youth Leadership Platform with your host, Bongani Dao. Follow the conversation on @simplybongani across all social media platforms, @YLPCliffCentral on Twitter and Instagram, Youth Leadership Platform on Facebook. Welcome to yet another exciting episode. And today, you might have gotten the sense from our intro that we are going futuristic, whatever that means. And we're focusing mostly on the movie Black Panther, but not so much the movie, but the narrative behind it. And I'm joined in studio by two powerful and elegant black ladies to join in the conversation. One of them is doing a master's and the other a PhD. So that's the kind of weight I'm carrying on my shoulders in today's conversation. So joining me in studio is Kolega and Rashida. Welcome to the studio, ladies.
Thank you so much for having us.
Here.
Yes. Thanks a lot for coming through. Let's get into it. I think we'll start off with the presentations. So Kolega, you can go ahead and speak more about African representation and just intro your presentation, and then we'll move to Rashida, and then we'll get into the nuances in the narrative itself.
Okay, thank you very much. I have titled my presentation "To Be an African Flying Machine: Afrofuturism and Blackness."
Okay.
In this presentation, I'll be using an expression that Thandiswa Mazwai utters in her song titled "Ibokwe." In it, she boldly states, "I am an African flying machine." This statement does multiple things. Firstly, it challenges the ludicrous idea that South Africans are not of Africa. Secondly, it suggests that black women can be anything they want to be. And thirdly, it draws on the Afrofuturistic practice wherein a queer black African woman is at the center of the narrative instead of existing on the margins. Here, she not only transforms into a flying machine, but she becomes an embodiment of diasporic movement. Although the phrase speaks of the flying machine as particularly African, it is clear that because ukundiza, or the act of flight, is not bound by colonial constructs like national borders and citizenship, the machine itself transcends Africa as an experience that is solely located within the African continent. The African flying machine goes where it wants, when it wants, and it always has amandla ukundiza, as seen in Simpiwe Dana's Ndiredi. In this context, the African flying machine is always ready to fly. It is sure of itself. In Thandiswa Mazwai's song, the flying machine is aware that a gaze rests upon it. It is aware that it is the object of fascination, and in resistance it speaks. The machine speaks and says, "Ungandibona when I'm doing my thing." In its utterance, it disrupts the idea that Africans are simply there to be gawked at without any agency of their own. In this universe, African flying machine is black woman, and black woman is African flying machine. In this plane of cyborgs, expansive skies, waters and land, blackness is not in flight from oppression, but is in flight to freedom. In this context, Africa is not pejorative. It is not synonymous with alienness, which can be read as otherworldliness, the peculiar, the unfamiliar, and the foreign. In this world, there are no foreigners, but I'm Africa in flight to Inkululeko. In the world of the African machine, alienness in Africa is paradoxical. In this world, to be alien is the stuff of Hollywood bioscope, where white American heterosexual men and women continue to single-handedly save planet Earth from extraterrestrial invasions. In this alien world, North America is Earth itself. It is the place where black men and women are meant to serve as backdrops and as casualties of violence. It is the world where black people are not meant to be the ones in spacesuits, conquering powerful silvery beings with saucer-like inky eyes that consume you until you are no more. The African flying machine is an Afrofuturistic concept, raptures this anti-black and anti-queer world. Through the idea of the African flying machine, Africans on the continent and in the diaspora can imagine themselves anew. Through the black radical imagination, otherness cannot be used as justification for atrocious acts of violence. Through it, Africans cease to be poverty-stricken, gang-banging, violent, disease-infested, primitive people from up there, out there, and nowhere. The African flying machine goes here, there, and everywhere. It belongs to Umhlaba, Earth, land, space.
And that is Kolega. And you know, I've got so many questions to ask you. But before we proceed and do that, I think we'll give Rashida her time. Okay. And then we'll get into the conversation.
Okay, perfect. So as a history of art student at WITS, my research is really centered around this idea of the black radical imagination. And I define this concept as this intrinsic force that acts as an instrument of liberation. It allows one to create without limitations, to reclaim their artistry, and to construct narratives that are reflective of their own African or diasporic experiences. The black radical imagination is really emerging as this powerful platform to examine and aestheticize creativity, and it involves the emancipation of thought, artistry, identity, and agency. The black radical imagination proposes these ideas of creating spaces that aren't restricting or limiting. It requires reclaiming and restructuring narratives so that they aren't victimizing, but instead empowering. Above all, the black radical imagination requires one to generate new narratives. So while my research really focused on the historical exclusions of the black radical imagination from visual art institutions like museums and galleries, substantial parts of black artistic productivity have been rendered invisible in other artistic mediums, whether it be literature, academia, science, and technology. And I think that this is why Afrofuturism was introduced as a genre to really disrupt and refigure those limited representations of blackness. Afrofuturism, as I know it, is a product of the black radical imagination through a black lens. It examines reimagining a future with art, science, and technology from our own black experiences. And I think that it's especially significant to look at the black radical imagination and its cohesion with Afrofuturism, especially depicted in Black Panther, which I'm sure we'll talk all about in a little bit. So yeah, that's the black radical imagination for me.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot. So here's the thing. I want us to, starting this conversation, to actually break down the word itself. So because there's a breakaway and there's a lot of paradoxes within the word itself, which is what I want us to unpack, and then move into this positive ideal that both the presentations outline. So let's talk about what would you describe Afrofuturism as?
Okay, well, for me, I'd describe it as really a constellation of blackness, African-American culture, science, technology, and the arts inspired by ancient African culture. At its most fundamental sense, that's how I understand Afrofuturism.
Okay. Kolega?
Yo, Afro means related to Africa or about Africa.
Yes.
And then futurism has to do with how one imagines themselves using science and technology.
Sure.
So it has to do with how black people can reimagine their own narratives and actually center their own narratives through science and technology, through sci-fi. Yeah.
Do you not have a problem with the etymology of the word? To describe a certain group of people, which is black, like you and me, but not to have come from a black person. Am I putting both of you on the spot right now?
Yeah.
No, it's okay.
That's the whole purpose of having a narrative, right?
Most definitely.
Yes, yes.
I think that it can become problematic because if you think about the term Afrofuturism, it wasn't coined until, 1993? And black people such as Sun Ra specifically has been the epitome of Afrofuturism in the 1950s. So I think that the term really came from this idea of a white man othering blackness and giving us this term. But I think that we appropriated it and made it our own. So, yeah, there are some contestations around it, but I think we've reclaimed it.
Colega, what do you think?
I think there's a very interesting relationship between theory and practice.
Okay.
Right. So a lot of the time, within the academic world, for instance, you find that we coin things, and because we are coining things, we think that that's when those things begin.
Okay.
So before the term feminism, there was already feminist practice in the world.
Sure.
So we don't need people to coin things and to name them before they start happening. Mm. So like Rashida's been saying, that Sun Ra and the orchestra, is it the orchestra?
The orchestra, yeah.
The orchestra existed in the 50s. This is before, way before this term was coined. So I don't know about this idea of naming and who gets to name and for what purposes. And I also don't know if we can appropriate or reappropriate every single name. I don't know if every name can be reappropriated. I don't know. Because some are just so pejorative that it's difficult to make them positive. Mm. So, yeah, this one, Afrofuturism, it's okay, it's all right. It's not bad, it's not too bad.
Yeah.
So would we find a suitable alternative to the word? Say for instance, I think words like Afrotopia still have that problem from an etymology point of view, how they were founded, who coined the terms. But okay, let's then focus on what are some of the problems that the movie itself or the representation in the movie have on the culture that they were trying to represent from South Africa? Let's get into that.
When we are talking about the movie, we are talking about Black Panther.
Sure.
It's so interesting how my brother and I were actually in the lift after watching Black Panther, and someone was on the phone talking about how everything is sold out. It's like, I couldn't get in. And automatically we assumed that he couldn't get into Black Panther because we're all in Black Panther mode. So when you talk about, let's focus on the movie, it could have been any movie. It's like, which movie? But we all know that we are talking about Black Panther.
Sure.
Rashida, do you want to take this one while I'm thinking?
Sure. You mentioned the problematic representations.
Sure. Yeah.
I feel like first and foremost, it was an honor for me as an African American to be able to experience the film in a South African context.
Okay.
And one thing that I noticed from the very visceral reactions of the crowd was the representation of isiXhosa.
Yes.
spoken you did that by. Perfectly. Thank you. I've been practicing.
I'm impressed.
Yes. So there were American actors who were speaking this South African language that obviously all the people in the theater could understand. And their reactions when they first started speaking were insane. They were not happy with the representation of one of their own South African languages. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that I think became a little bit problematic for some people. What else? To me personally, I really wanted to focus on the positive representations because I feel like that's what I noted more.
Okay.
And I feel like the film did a great job of representing the multiplicities of what it means to be an African.
Okay.
Like oftentimes we like to use African as this all-encompassing term, and I think that it doesn't allow us to acknowledge the nuance and the specificity that exists within the continent, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I felt like these representations of Africanness were so vast. I mean, people from the Akan cultures and the Maasai and obviously Xhosa and Ndebele were represented. And I feel like South Africa specifically was represented to the fullest. They were playing like Babes Wodumo and other South African music. So, yeah, I think that for me as an outsider looking in, I feel like they did a pretty decent job presenting diverse representations of what it means to be African.
Mm.
Yeah.
Colega, what was your experience? And let's talk from a point of knowing and coming from South Africa and coming from a particular culture, knowing what certain rites and cultural wear represents and means to the people and what it should mean to society and how it was adapted to this narrative that was told from a Western point of view.
That is a very loaded question asked to a young black woman who hardly practices.
Who's powerful. Don't.
Yeah,
don't dim your light.
Yeah, but also I'm a product. This. I'm a product of a white institution called Wits University. as much as, you know, yes, I grew up in the township and I went to Ekabangaye Primary School, but at some point went to a private school, got displaced Nami from my own, you know, culture.
Sure.
So I cannot speak as a custodian of, you know, the culture of AmaZulu, for instance, because I have some knowledge, it's truncated because of my encounters with whiteness through like school and stuff. So I feel like there should be like an older, you know, person to talk about these issues because really, I don't feel like I don't feel equipped. I don't feel equipped. But what I can say is that I also went into it very aware. I mean, when I say went into, you know, watching the film, very aware of the conversations that were happening prior to me watching it.
Sure.
So there were many conversations around the fact that this is a Marvel, you know, production. Even though a black male director is at the helm of it, it's still under Marvel. It's still produced within a white institution that we call Hollywood.
Sure.
So it has, that institution has particular ideas around blackness.
Sure.
And some people were saying that, why now? It just seems convenient because, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement is happening. It's still happening. You know, it never stopped. With the call to decolonize,
sure.
You know. And so it's like, is this a way for Hollywood to be on the right side of history while making money at the same time? That's part of the conversation. And we can't deny the fact that Hollywood is powerful and that it's got, white capital behind it.
Sure.
But at the same time, there is something very important about a black person being at the helm and being able to represent blackness.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, you know, there were 5 tribes in the film.
Sure.
I have issues with the idea of tribe.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Babu Achi Mafeje talks about how, you know, the idea of tribe is a colonial construct.
Okay.
You know, Zulus versus Xhosas versus Tswanas and so on and so on. And I use those terms specifically because that's how, you know, whiteness has written us into history. So it's Zulu, not isZulu. Xhosa, not isXhosa. And so on and so on. You know what I mean? So it's like a shorthand for those who can't pronounce things. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So I was appreciative of the fact that attention was paid to, you know, the costumes. And I say costumes because I'm working within the genre of film here, you know, and I'm understanding that I'm working within a framework wherein, you know, we're dealing with a fictional narrative.
Sure.
You know, so Isixholo within that context might not necessarily function the same way that it
does in real life.
KZN.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? So this is a representation. It's a three-dimensional representation of a story. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important. I don't know, sometimes we see images and we think those images are truth. They are a history, they are not the history.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so when I watch a film, I watch it very much aware of what films are meant to do.
Yeah.
You know, there's this, so in theater, there's something called the fourth wall. So when you go in to watch a play,
sure.
You know, Uguti, as an audience member, don't now go and jump on stage and start interacting with the characters. Even though the wall is not there, you understand the codes and conventions of theater. Like,
yes.
you don't clap now. You don't talk to the characters.
Sure.
And what I found interesting about that entire experience, actually being in Black Panther, was the fact that the fourth wall was constantly broken by the audience. Mm. People were speaking to T'Challa, like, hey, when? It was so wonderful, you know. And I've always seen that as an American experience, actually, because watching Black American films, you know, and it's like in the hood and people are like, run, run, run. Mm. And I've never had that experience, actually, from an African perspective.
Sure.
I understood that when you go into a cinema, you know, you go in, you sit and you just look at the image and you appreciate. And so, you know, finding myself surrounded by Black people wearing their 3D glasses talking about, you know, why is this guy doing this or that? Oh,
yeah.
Yes, girl, yes, and clapping.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That was really beautiful for me. So it's really hard for me to solely focus on the negative because there'll always be negatives.
Sure.
I know, Uguti, there was a very, very valid, you know, critique where people were saying that there was an absence of queer representation in the film. That's very,
which
very...
Which scenes were deleted, by the way?
Yeah, I mean, that's something quite valid. It's very valid, and we need to think about this idea, this big word called intersectionality. So how someone can be oppressed and have privilege at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that Ryan Coogley is a Black man who is heterosexual. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So he's got heterosexual privilege in that situation. And what is privilege? Privilege is that thing that you don't have to worry about. If you don't have to think about it, it means it's privilege.
Sure.
So he takes it for granted and doesn't include it for whatever purpose, even though it's included in the comic. So, I mean, of course, those things are there, and we cannot act like that is not an issue. That is an issue.
So let's talk a bit about queer representation in different movies and focus just slightly, for a minute, on movies like Inxeba, for instance, and the outcry and the outbreak that has come from that. Do you feel that, you know, we are all fighting for equality, whether you're feminist, whether you're just Black or you're queer, or in any regard and in any form, we all fighting for a sense of equality. Do you think there's exclusivity in this quest for equality, this quest for a kind of freedom? Because in all honesty, with the films and the movies that have come out, we can find a lot of problems in Black Panther that we can find in Inxeba. But Black Panther is, and it's got the clout, and Inxeba is banned from cinema. Let's talk a bit about that.
is it me again? Okay. Yo, you know, it's funny, actually, what's happening here, because I'm straight, so, and by straight, I mean, it's such problematic language. I'm a heterosexual, you know, Black woman.
Sure.
And I find it interesting how right now, in this particular moment in time, it's almost like queer people don't exist. They're not there to speak for themselves. And by virtue of me just simply speaking about queerness, not having the experience of it, it plays into this idea that they are not there. They are not visible. They are absent. They are somewhere out there living, and the people that get to be the mouthpieces are still heterosexual people.
So the privilege there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this privilege of being here talking about queerness when it's not my experience.
Sure.
It's not my experience. I live in a heteronormative society that doesn't question my sexuality at any point, right? So to speak about Inxeba and queerness, yo, I feel like I am not... Again, I feel ill-equipped always because it's not my experience. Mm. But also, I know what it is to be oppressed. So as someone who experiences oppression, I understand when people want to center their narratives and want to center their lived experiences. And I understand that outcry, you know, that why should we... Because it's like criminalizing queerness, actually. Mm. You know, it's like, oh, it's pornographic.
Gay love equals to porn. Mm.
Exactly. Headlines. But we can watch Abo Malena. You know, I grew up watching Malena, guys. Abo Malena, good days. She in days of our lives. But I watched Uprook, you know, doing things. I was like 12.
Sure.
You know, and no one said, pornographic, this thing.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, queerness comes in and, you know, we ban films in 2018.
Sure. Where there's freedom of expression.
Where are we?
And it's very reminiscent of the apartheid regime.
Rashida.
Yeah, very much so. When there were certain books that people weren't allowed to read. So this idea of censorship, I think, is counteractive to the type of progress that's supposed to be taking place in a democratic South Africa.
Yeah. Where do we draw the line? Now, coming back to the cultural aesthetic of the movie and just the idea of Afrofuturism, where do we draw the line of cultural inappropriation when it comes to telling narratives like this? Because we're going to a place and we're coming to a time where a lot of us now want to represent ourselves. Where we've got that platform now that we can rise up and actually tell our own stories. I think they're going to do Born a Crime by Trevor Noah. Lupita Nyong'o is working on that. Mm-hmm. And Lupita and Danai Gurira are also working on Chimamanda's Americana.
Mm.
They want to do a feature film on that. So when it comes to representation and when we're adapting that to, making a film, where do we draw the line in terms of cultural inappropriation?
I personally think that the line should be drawn when the culture that you're trying to represent is being ostracized from the creation, right? So with me and Black Panther, for example, I really appreciated the fact that there was this like transatlantic collaboration between Black people in the diaspora and here on the continent. So I think that it's imperative to consult with these cultures and have them as involved as possible in that process of generating a narrative that's reflective of themselves. So I think the line is drawn when that acknowledgement isn't there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when they adapted isiXhosa, for instance, to be part of the language in conversation within the movie itself, you feel that did justice to the culture and...
I think so, because the origins of it even being the official language of Wakanda came from John Connie working on Captain America. And he was confused as to why he was talking to his son, T'Challa, in English when they're from Wakanda, right?
Oh, yes.
So it was him who said, you know, we need to incorporate an African language and I can teach you. So it was someone coming from this particular place and culture and then allowing someone else to be a part of it through teaching them. And I think that that's vital to any type of representation of another culture outside of your own.
Colleague, what are your sentiments? Yes.
I've always felt that there's a lot of power behind the camera.
Okay.
And I think it is important for Africans. So in this context, in the context of Black Panther, I think it is important to have Africans making decisions. When I say Africans, I mean people located within the continent.
Okay.
Also making creative, decisions.
Sure.
And that intervention by Ubab John Kani is critical, because I remember being in the cinema, and as soon as, Watandwa Kani spoke, it's cause people were just clapping, and there was such a sense of pride. And as Rashida was saying, that whenever, you know, American, you know, actors then spoke in African languages, then there was like a response from Africans within the continent.
Sure.
Just finding it highly problematic that, you know, the accents were not worked on.
Sure.
And I think it is important to have someone behind the scenes who is of, not of African descent, but someone who is located within the continent and understands the languages, so that that person can emphasize the importance of actually knowing and training one's tongue. I mean, you know, we've trained our tongues to speak this English,
sure,
right?
Sure.
So I'm sure also we learned about Stanislavski at WITS.
Sure.
I can say it so easily now. I struggled at first.
Sure.
So yeah, Mdana Sekaya in the movie, you can also say that. And it just requires like training. I mean, we learned like Shakespeare. We didn't even understand what was happening with that heightened text, you know.
Sheesh.
But you learned.
Medieval English.
Yeah, we learned. So I believe that as long as you're an actor and you respect your craft, you are going to learn how to pronounce. So I feel like also the responsibility lies with the director to really emphasize that, no, actually, you need to do that again. And again and again, I felt like the character of the Queen Mother, played by Angela Bassett, she did more work than most.
Sure.
I'm talking in relation to the accents, you know.
Yeah.
So when she spoke, I didn't feel like, what is she saying?
Yeah.
And the subtitling was very important, because I felt like if I'd closed my eyes and I'd listened sometimes when the Americans were speaking the isiXhosa or isiZulu, I wouldn't have known what was being said. Sometimes it felt like that. It was so fast, and the accent was kind of off, that, yeah, I needed also to read my own language. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A paradox in linguistic, What's the term for it? But in essence, it was a paradox that you're speaking in your own language, but
I'm reading it.
Exactly.
That was crazy. But I appreciated the effort. Mm. But I saw it's okay. I did go into it kind of expecting, because it's American. I was like, okay, sharp. Like, these are the things that you should anticipate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As a you know, there's this scholar called Bell Hooks, and she talks about spectatorship and black people and how black people watch movies.
Yeah.
And how she interviewed, you know, black women in particular, just their relationship to cinema, and how a lot of the time black women have to hype yourself up before watching a movie, because you know what, you're not going to be represented.
Yeah.
Either you're not there or you're just like on the margins. So, but you still want to enjoy the movie. So they found ways to kind of silence that critical part of themselves at times to cope with the image on screen. And that's violent, man. Like, when you actually have to silence parts of yourself to cope with what you are seeing on screen. Mm. So she has this idea of the oppositional gaze.
Yeah.
Like, looking to resist. She talks about how looking relations have always been political, even on plantations. So just because the Maasai is there doesn't mean that I'm not going to look at him. I'm gonna take my time and look, even if he can't see me. It's like how, you know, we are taught not to look. So she talks about how children are taught not to look directly into the eyes of adults.
Yeah.
But you know, as a child, you looked sometimes.
Sure.
You looked, and then you just looked long enough not to be seen, but you know what you resisted in that moment.
Sure.
So she talks about how spectatorship is about resistance, and how we look. So the characters in the movie look at us, right? Or they look at each other, and while they're looking at each other, we're looking at them. So black characters in you know, in cinema, it is important to have moments where the fourth wall is ruptured, in the sense that you might find a character looking directly at the camera and you feel like, yo, the fourth wall is no longer there. It's supposed to be like that sometimes, to remind you, ukuthi, this is a representation.
Yeah, it's not the actual thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we are breaking the fourth wall because we see you. So it's important for characters to also see who's looking at them and they look back and they see you and they name you through their eyes.
Let's break away for a bit from the seriousness of this conversation and speak a bit about a future, an ideal future from each of you in an African context, or where Africans are actually thriving, because that has been the mandate and what we've been fighting for centuries now. Mm. An ideal.
As a black woman, I think that an ideal future for me would be an opportunity to really exist outside of exploitation and oppression and the violence that really is inflicted upon women of color every single day in every facet of our existence. So for me, I'd like to exist outside of a white gaze, outside of a male gaze, outside of hypersexuality, outside of objectification. So I can only speak on a future for me as a black woman. I don't think I can prophesize how I want.
For everyone.
I mean, equality for everyone at its fundamental sense, most sure. definitely. Sure. Yes. That's a future for me.
Colega?
Future. You know, just to go back to Black Panther, as the spaceship was like kind of hovering, you know, all that land, it looked so good. It looked so good.
You want the land.
The livestock. Do you see those yes. young boys with the livestock? It looked so good. I was appreciating mm-hmm. black people on all this land. So that in itself, you know, there's this joke where people talk about why there's the stereotype of the loud black person. And they say that it's because we had so much land that we needed to scream to reach the neighbor. And really, I don't know what it is to own land
okay.
and to decide what it is that I want to do with umhlaba.
Sure.
And I don't think it's a mistake that in my language, umhlaba means, and even its cause, you know, umhlaba has to do with the soil, but also it has to do with the world. You know, I find such richness in African languages because they can capture so much all at once. So when people are talking about umhlaba wethu, they're not just talking about, you know, the soil, but they also talk about the world, because Africans are contemporary beings that move through space and time. Mm. So the diaspora is very important to me. And I think those transatlantic conversations are important, that when people are talking about Trayvon, I'm also touched in sure. Africa, because, sure. you know, he is a part of me, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I want land and resources and wealth, and I want... Yeah, I want our knowledge, you know, indigenous knowledge systems, to become part and parcel of institutions like Wits University.
Yeah.
I think it's very important for students to be able to write in whatever languages they want to. If you want to write a thesis in Isixhosa, then you should be able. Because surely there are many scholars who have specialized in Isicamtho and Isixhosa. So why can't you theorize in Isixhosa? That's the world that I imagine for myself and
sure.
my children, where I don't have to worry about safety for a young black woman, you know. I don't have to live in a world where if violence happens, then it's like, what was she doing there? You know what I'm saying? I don't want to live in a world where you are violated because of who you love. I don't want to live in a world where a film is banned because queer people are in it.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like, I don't know. This is South Africa, actually. We want Tanzania. This is not it. This is not what Biko fought for. This is not what Sobukwe fought for.
Sure.
This is not what Abu Miriam Tlali fought for.
This is not it.
This is not the dream. This is not the dream. I still haven't seen freedom. I don't know what Nkululeko is. Like Umam Asara Shaku, you know, she talks about you asking me about freedom. I know a whole lot more about what freedom isn't than what it is. Yeah, I know what it isn't. Mm. I do know what it isn't. I don't know Nkululeko.
Mm.
And people think because I'm sitting in front of this mic and PhD, banbani, masters, you know, it's not enough.
Yeah.
They are still...
Where your PhD will land you on a traffic light somewhere asking for a job.
Mm. You know,
should be naturally recognized.
Mm. Exactly. And there are just not enough of us in these institutions. And when I say us, I mean black women. Mm. They're not enough of us. And I get so excited when I see, you know, black women in positions of power, because I'm like, yes, you're doing it for me too. Whatever field, you know, whatever field it is, I get excited. I really do.
What's your guys' take on, you know, I get the sense that with Afrofuturism in what it's being portrayed to be, because it means different things to different people, but, you know, the overarching concept and ideation of it, don't you think it's a social futuristic paradox? Because it places us at a point where black people have a sense of leadership and power and freedom, but from a practical point of view, now taking it away from a production point of view, from the practical point of view, we live in a world where South Africa needs to adapt to AI while there's someone who's suffering from basic needs like access to clean toilets, access to water, and we hear online shopping. We're doing all these different things from that Western world. What do you think about this? I'm going to challenge you. if we're going the master's route, and we're gonna write theories, this is the level at which we should be having these conversations.
Most definitely. Yeah. And I'm trying to grasp this idea of a paradox. So what you're saying, if I understand correctly, is that we have all these technological advances, or we're trying to get to this technological utopia, right?
Yeah.
Whereas there are still people who don't have their basic needs. Of course, that's a contradiction, because to me, it's like, what's the priority?
Yeah.
What's the priority of having these platforms if the majority of the people can't use them? So, yeah, I think that it comes down to positions of power, inclusion and exclusion. So I think that that's why it's important for us to have people who have maybe gone through those experiences creating a future that's beneficial for all instead of an outside.
Mm.
Yeah.
And we you see, this is a perspective thing, what I'm going to bring up, and you're going to speak on the sentiments of what I just asked. We're celebrating, which is partly a good, like I said, it's a perspective thing. We're celebrating 1 million in money that can be used to watch Black Panther, when there's heck of more than millions of kids that don't have access to basic stuff, even access to education, where that money could be spent on. You know, what's happening, it's very fascinating to think about these different things and look at them from different perspectives. But you were about to say, colega?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Rashida has said most of the things that I was thinking, but in terms of that, it's really hard, because it sounds like you know, when you are sitting here complaining about the underrepresentation of a particular people within a film, you're talking about nice life problems, right? It's like you are out here talking about a character in a movie, and there's a person in real life
that's
who doesn't have access,
sure,
to resources. But what I also remember, having grown up in the township of Ulundi, was how important the bioscope was. And I keep calling it bioscope because that was the language that we used.
We used, yes.
Lokshini. And when we went to that school, man, and the sheet was up and the projector, and Bruce Lee is there doing his thing.
Jackie China.
Yo, I mean, I'm old, bruh. So this is even before Jackie China. This is like Bruce Lee times,
sure,
you know. And I just remember the joy of it. It has to do with this idea of also, it's like how images travel. Like they don't. So they don't subscribe to this idea of borders, and I can go to New York right now. I can go to Brooklyn right now by,
sure,
watching a Spike Lee joint.
Sure.
You know, I can go to, it's like books, you know, you visit places without ever going there, because,
sure,
some of us don't have the resources to go to New York. So we're going to go see Hamba nge movie, right? So sizohamba nge bioscope. And I traveled, man. I've been to all sorts of places without having the resources. And I think it is important to cultivate the imagination of those kids.
Sure.
To show them, Uguti, actually, you too, I think images are so important. Sure. You too can do this. Mm. So it's not just an image. Yes, it is, but it isn't at the same time.
Sure.
It influences how you see yourself. And by virtue of you seeing someone who looks like you, you know, doing something powerful,
amazing, yes.
You think, yo, maybe I can do it too. You know what I'm saying?
Definitely.
Yeah, so I think it's an unfair question, because of course we care.
Sure.
You know, the reason why we even talking about the black radical imagination and talking about African flying machines and music and all of
into,
that,
yes.
You know, it's because we care about the black condition. Mm. That's why we are all here. We are all here pursuing our studies, doing all sorts of things in the world because we want to break boundaries.
Sure.
I think that's the biggest thing.
Sure.
So if an image can help me to see myself in a different way, if a song,
you offer it.
If a song can tell me Gutinda Bayami straight and I dingy rule and that means something to me,
yeah,
then I think that person has done more than enough. And I think about Umam Nina Simone and how she talks about the role of the artist in the world.
Sure.
And how the artist has to reflect the times.
Sure.
Without art, what are you gonna use your money for? You know?
At the core of art, I think, was sublimation. Excuse me. Coined by Sigmund Freud. Because you look at the Harlem Renaissance. You look at the African Renaissance. You look at the people at the forefront of that. Most of those people, Sarafina, I sat across Ubabumbongi Ngema on one occasion. And he spoke about how that was an outlet for him, where he was reflecting. That burying a loved one every single week, a comrade every week, it's something that was happening at that particular point in time. Nina Simone, to be young, gifted, and black, telling other people that all I wanted to do was be a classic piano player. Mm. But I can travel the world and I can do amazing things as an artist. And fight as much as we're fighting for freedom, look, so be free in yourself. Be free, and that's what art gave people, that sense of freedom to express themselves, at least in part, in something. So now, my question, or, you know, to round this up and to conclude, is your message in the use of black radical imagination to advocate for, not really advocate, but to lead the society of black young creatives and just black young kids, really, to a place where they're actually free in themselves and they can translate that into its physical counterpart?
Most definitely. I think that at the center of the idea is the right to exercise your own agency. So for me, it's up to us on an individual basis to get us where we need to be. So each one of us doing what we can in order to ensure our collective freedom, right? So yeah, the idea of the Black Radical Imagination is to really allow people to understand their own power. Although we might be facing oppression, we still continue to be innovative. We still continue to create despite all of that.
Sure.
So as long as we internalize this idea that I as an individual can help a collective, then that's definitely fundamental to creating a black future filled with freedom to me.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Colega?
To speak about freedom, I'm going to go back to Nina Simone and how she talks about what freedom means to her. And she says it's no fear. Yeah. No fear. That's it. Don't be afraid to be creative. Right? And by that, I mean, don't be afraid to push boundaries. Don't be afraid to have a black superhero.
Sure.
You know, I think Black Panther was a very fearless project.
Sure.
You know, it's just the beginning. Black Panther is just the, well, it's not the beginning. There are many, many things that happened before it. But there's something quite powerful about the fact that all over the world, people are mobilizing to go watch this thing that appears to just be an image, nje.
Yeah.
But it speaks to our condition as black people all over the world. Mm. And I want to lastly talk about let me call it Professor Phumla Dineo Qola.
Sure.
And she's got this text called Ufanele Uqavile, Black Women, Feminisms and Postcoloniality in Africa. And I love how she uses metaphor as a way to understand how oppression works. And she talks about, and she draws from another scholar whose name I can't remember at the moment, but she talks about the seven mountains on a black woman's back. And it speaks to what Rashida is saying about how, despite the oppression, we are still able to create, we are still able to innovate. And so with the seven mountains on our backs, we're still able to navigate spaces and we're still able to Wakanda everywhere, right? Because it's a vet. And so oppression doesn't stop us from being great.
Sure.
We are great despite it, but we will overthrow it. And we're working. And this is what we each have a role to play. So it's not everyone who's going to be in the front lines, you know, during our protests. Some people might make films. Some might write books. Some might be there in the front lines. Some might be making music and so on and so on. So know what your... So whatever it is that you're passionate about, use that. I think people should use that to subvert systems of power.
Sure.
And that is a very scary thing. So fearlessness is necessary.
Very necessary.
Agreed.
Hey, because there's a lot of people that they silenced.
Yeah, there's a cost.
Fish.
There's a cost for being fearless. There's a cost. And Nina Simone is an example of that.
Yeah.
She died.
Dementia.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a cost to being brave, and it's not everyone who can take that risk, because you don't want to, you know, death comes sometimes. Like people have died for being radical.
Sure.
So Tina, we out here making movies, and I mean, a movie is banned. That is the scariest thing to me, because it means we live in an unsafe world society where actually you can't create as you wish.
What how can people get in touch with you and follow your life stories?
I'm on social media as a typical millennial. And my Twitter handle is @absolute_fiasco.
Okay. Across board.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we had a conversation about this earlier. So my Twitter handle at the moment uses my very old name. I used to be called Upelinda. It's still that because I'm not active really, but it's Belinda K. Shange on Twitter, but Kolega B. Shange on Facebook, and at Kolega Shange on Instagram.
Well, thanks a lot for coming through and hanging with us and imparting some of the pearls that you have as young as you are. And I think in line with our conversation and speaking about heroes, you personally my heroes.
Thank you for
being the people that you are and pursuing your respective passions. And I feel that everyone that is going to listen and that has listened to the show will learn a thing or two from you, and we can move to a society where we have no fear. At Simply Bongani across all board, this is the Youth Leadership Platform.
This is CliffCentral.com.